From the Tuscan coast of Italy, I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Next week, British voters will decide whether or not to withdraw from the European Union. Today, I'll talk about the so-called Brexit with Mitchell Smith, the director of the University of Oklahoma's European Union Center.
So I don't think the British people have really heard consistently over the decades a strong case for membership in the European Union.
But first, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss political developments in Italy regarding the Roman mayoral election, as well as the conflict and corruption surrounding the precious gem trade in Afghanistan.
It's a weird case in the sense that it not only shows really the resource curse that gems and other resources can have, but it really highlights the lack of rule of law.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. Rebecca Cruz, I'm still here in Italy and you're back at home, but we're going to connect and talk about something we're seeing happening in Italy right now, the upcoming runoff for the Roman mayoral election. The Cinque Stelle candidate is actually in the runoff, and this is big news. We met with the Cinque Stelle, Movimento Cinque Stelle, the Five Stars movement. This is an anti-establishment party. They're very young, a young party. The party's only been involved in politics for about 6-7 years. So this is a big step for them that they are now competing for a big mayor position like Rome.
Yeah, the Movimento, as you said, they have a new party or a non-party really pointing towards direct democracy. The idea being that they had seen decades of corruption, particularly political corruption, and wanted to give government back to the people. And so in 2009, they were officially created. They have five main points, which is why they're the five-star movement. Public water, sustainable transportation, sustainable development, free internet access. And the final one is environmental protection. And yes, this is a huge deal, but it's not entirely unprecedented, as they've had really kind of remarkable success since they were started. I think a lot of people thought this was kind of a flash in the pan. They were going to get out in the streets and put some measures out, but then they would disappear. But they have had some success, really quite a bit of success across Italy. And here in the 2013 elections, the national elections, there's anywhere from 20-30% of Movimento representatives in the two Italian houses, as well as in the European Parliament. So this is going to be a big deal, and it does look like the candidate, female, is likely to win. Now, some of this is support for Movimento, but in large part, this is also a reaction against the current prime minister, 41-year-old Renzi, who's a Florentine mayor who rose to his position a couple of years ago, incredible approval ratings, 74%. This year, he's been embroiled in all sorts of scandals, corruption, and actually his approval ratings have sunk dramatically. And so this is kind of a referendum on him, as well as a larger referendum on the corruption of Italian politics.
Well, it's definitely worth watching this movement here in Italy. Brings some hope, I think, just to the younger generation. We're hearing from many of them. And we met actually with one of the Cinque Stelle European parliamentarians. So they're even represented not only in Italy, but in the European Parliament. So definitely something to watch. It's a big race in Rome, and it'll be coming up. That runoff will be coming up soon. Well, let's switch to Afghanistan and talk for a second about the trade in precious gems. Now, we're used to talking about things like blood diamonds and their support for insurgencies and conflict and war. But in Afghanistan, a lapis mine, a precious blue stone that has been taken over a couple years ago, actually, by the militia, but is now really starting to get some attention, considering this mine is worth about $125 million a year. The gems that come out of that mine are worth quite a bit and would mean a lot to Afghanistan if that could really help them grow economically. But instead, it seems that this is contributing to conflict and corruption in this war-torn country.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story. As you mentioned, it's creating conflict. You have militia involved. You actually have the Taliban involved, too. And this is in the northeastern area. And that's not an area that they were very strong. But because this resource is now available and they have the ability or have had the ability to make money off of it, they have a gain in their power up there. It's a weird case in the the sense that it not only shows really the resource curse that gems and other resources can have, but it really highlights the lack of rule of law. So the mine was put up for bid in 2013, and there was a company that won the bid. It was a local company, a family company, and they very quickly lost control to these militia groups. The government has now come in and said that that contract is void because the company allowed the militia groups to take it over, and so they're now seeking to give the contract to someone else. So this family mining company has really no recourse because the government is not supporting them. So highlighting again the rule of law issues that and really, you know, 15 years of U.S. involvement there, pro-democracy stance, a war, and still very little rule of law.
Definitely a troubling situation in Afghanistan, but of course it calls into question other gemstones around the world, countries like Nigeria, Myanmar, Burma, South Africa, other places in South Asia and the Middle East. I mean, this is a problem perhaps across the board. So we'll keep watching this issue as well. Thank you very much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. We welcome your comments in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. You can also get in touch with us via KGOU's Facebook page or through Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Suzek Rolot. After a short break, I'm joined by my colleague Mitchell Smith. He directs the University of Oklahoma's European Union Center, and we're going to talk about next week's vote that could result in the UK leaving the EU. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolot. 6 days from now, British voters will decide on whether or not to leave the European Union. The referendum establishes a formal process for withdrawing from the community. British citizens have been debating the value of membership since it joined the European Economic Community 43 years ago. Here to lay out what's at stake in Thursday's vote is my colleague Mitchell Smith. He's the Associate Dean and a professor in the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and also directs OU's European Union Center. Mitchell Smith, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, as an expert on the European Union, I'd like to talk about the upcoming vote in the UK. On June 23rd, I believe, they're going to vote whether to leave the European Union. This is, of course, we're all familiar with the fact that the European Union's been struggling the past several years, economic crisis, various other things. But the UK has always had kind of an awkward relationship with the rest of the European Union anyway, not being on continental Europe. They kind of see themselves as outsiders. They never joined the monetary union. So give us a little bit of the background here and how we got here to begin with. Why are they even considering leaving the European Union?
Sure. Two things. Let's start with how we got to the referendum itself, and then we'll go back a little bit further to the awkward relationship. The referendum actually, I think, is very much a product of just political dynamics. Prior to the last election, which took place in May of 2015, the last general election, the UK Independence Party, which is the very strongly Eurosceptic party, was gaining ground very significantly electorally and kept pressuring the Prime Minister Cameron to say whether or not what the position of his government would be toward the European Union. And actually, more the leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, more or less cornered Cameron into promising a referendum if the Conservatives won the next election, which they did. So in some ways, it was a sort of a political cornering of Cameron that happened, and one that could, you know, that had the potential from the start to backfire. And we could talk about what the potential outcome will be and the consequences, of course. Prior to that, though, I would say that most accounts of the British relationship with the EU tend to focus on culture, and I don't actually embrace those arguments. Ever since the British became part of the European Union back in 1973, there really has not been any powerful advocacy for the European Union within the UK. And if you look at the press in Britain over the decades, it's just staunchly anti-EU and constantly critical. And there's really no party that has made the case for EU membership and the benefits of EU membership. The Labour Party in the early 1980s turned far to the left and was somewhat skeptical about the EU itself. And then as it became more centrist during the course of the 1980s, the party itself was divided and didn't talk much about Europe. Meanwhile, with Margaret Thatcher and then following Thatcher, conservatives tended to be sort of Eurosceptic. And so there was no advocacy from that side either. So I don't think the British people have really heard consistently over the decades a strong case for membership in the European Union.
Now, have they been hearing anything about the costs of leaving the European Union? Because obviously there are significant, it would seem to me at least at a minimum, economic costs to leaving, but other political and social costs to leaving a rather strong, although struggling, union like the European Union.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that the EU struggles with generally is that the costs of membership are readily visible and the benefits are not visible. So one thing that's played very prominently in the debate over the referendum has been the budget contribution that the British government has to make. And that's just a tangible figure one could look at and reduce it to a weekly amount or an annual amount. And what we hear is that every week, 350 million British pounds go to the European Union, and that's, you know, it's very easy to compare it to portions of the national budget. Apparently, that's about half of the budget that goes to education in Britain. So when people hear that, it sounds like, wow, this would be tremendous savings from being outside of this entity. What they can't see, and what nobody has really been able to tally up very carefully and accurately, of course, is all the benefits of being in the European Union, which include the trade benefits, the benefits of foreign direct investment that has flocked into Britain because they're part of the European single market, which is really the greatest accomplishment of the whole project. And, you know, most estimates of those benefits suggest they're 8 or 9 times as large as the budget contribution. But those are not tangible things that the British people see. So I think they see the costs much more heavily. And by the way, this is true, I think, throughout the European Union. People see the costs more readily than they see the benefits. What I think is different in the British case is what I said earlier, that there doesn't seem to be a party that has consistently made the case for the value of being in the European Union.
I'm talking with Mitchell Smith, who directs the University of Oklahoma's European Union Center. We're discussing next week's vote that could lead to the United Kingdom leaving the EU. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Corlett, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlett, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to my conversation with my colleague, Mitchell Smith. He's an expert on the European Union, and we've been talking about the so-called Brexit referendum that could lead to the United Kingdom leaving the EU. So let's go back. I want to pick up on the cultural argument again. I mean, this isn't the first time that the UK has actually debated as to whether they should stay in Europe, if you will. Back when they were considering leaving, for example, the European Economic Community before it even became the European Union. So there seems to be some underlying, you refer to skepticism, you know, skepticism about being a part of this union. But I'm wondering if it's growing at all from a cultural perspective because of one of the benefits of course being in the EU is free movement of people, not just money and labor, but just people, and people of all different kinds of backgrounds. And as the European Union has expanded to the East, you have, of course, East Europeans and Central Europeans that have been able to move around Europe easily. And so what role does immigration play? Because, you know, the UK is so different today than it was even 20 years ago, let's say, the last time that they were considering whether to leave Europe. And I don't mean that geographically, right? We mean politically, leaving Europe politically and economically. So, you know, what role, if any, does that play? Is that a visible benefit to them, or do they see that as largely a cost?
Well, again, I think immigration is an issue that plays out in Britain in ways that are not dissimilar from other places. You know, we have issues with immigration in the United States where there are those who tally up the relative costs and benefits, and many claim that there are net benefits of this. But it's relatively easy for politicians to make the case that this is taking jobs away from people and is costly to us. In Britain, the same dynamic has played out. So again, I think what people see is kind of a drain on their social welfare system, encroachment on their labor markets, large numbers of people coming in. And you know, to be fair about this, when one looks across the channel at what's happening in the European Union these days, it does become very hard to make a positive case. Things are not going well in the European Union. What we have is this refugee crisis, which is a complete disaster. on top of the Eurozone crisis. And so when people in Britain see that, you know, it becomes much harder to make a positive case for this than to make a case that, you know, we'd be better off just shorn of this entire entity.
So do you think that there's a fair amount of kind of fear-mongering about some of those issues, but also fear-mongering about leaving Europe, that there's it seems like there people are coming at it from both sides, that they're like, look, we're afraid to leave because we don't know exactly what the costs are going to be and what it's going to look like if we go. But we're, you know, we don't want to stay. And there's a tremendous amount of fear because of all of these, you know, things that we've just been talking about, immigrants and other things, all the costs, you know, all the money going out to mainland Europe or whatever. It just seems like there's no real, I think, as you started by saying, there's no optimism about it. It's all fear, even really, from both sides.
Yeah. And I think that that's an outgrowth of the fact that the future course is unknown and unknowable. All we could do is project what the consequences would be in either direction. And of course, depending upon which side of the issue you're on, you make one case or the other. I will say that just very recently, the Bank of England warned that withdrawal from the EU could lead to a recession. And I think there are many who make economic arguments that suggest this would be costly to Britain to leave. On the other hand, there are those who tally up all of the economic gains. And what they argue is that by leaving, Britain would then be able to recapture any potential losses by renegotiating various trade deals and such. And this is all where, you know, there's unknown territory. What will the bargaining position of Britain look like? It is a sizable economy, but it does not carry the weight in the world that it once did. And outside the European Union, it's a much smaller voice. So when the UK enters into negotiations over a trade deal with China, are they going to do as well as they do as part of the European Union? I think it's probably reasonable to assume not. Those who argue for leaving suggest that Britain will be able to negotiate deals and they'll have more flexibility and independence to do so. Whether or not that could bring them a better deal is questionable. But nonetheless, those advocating to leave make the case that this is something they'd be able to do.
It sounds to me like there's just such a significant amount of uncertainty that's being emphasized, again, on both sides. So that raises a question in my mind about leadership on these issues and kind of, you know, where everybody's kind of stacking themselves up. Prime Minister Cameron, of course, you know, taking a certain perspective. We've got a new mayor in London that's now, you know, kind of changed the perspective within London. London's a very different city. There's a huge influx of people and cash, and the UK is a very expensive place to be and to live. It's hard to make a living there now, especially if you're in a place like London or any other big city. So, I mean, how is it that they, you know, can even think that leaving, and I mean, let's face it, the UK is pretty small space, leave Europe and really do well. But at the same time, you know, what kind of leadership qualities they need in these people to really kind of work the, you know, help them work through it without the fear mongering, without the emphasis on uncertainty, but to really have, I guess, develop, for lack of a better way of putting it, a vision for the future of the UK.
Yeah, and I think another way of asking that same question is whether or not the current government, the Cameron government, is making the most effective case possible. You know, a prior step to this was that once Cameron was backed into that political corner of calling the referendum, he then embarked on an effort to renegotiate the terms of British membership in the European Union so that he could come back to the British people and say, I've gotten a better deal for us. Now we can confirm our membership. And I think it's widely understood that he got relatively little in that process. It's really fascinating to look at what happened in that process. One of the most contested pieces of this was an effort to have Britain exempted from the commitment to ever closer union, which are the words in the preamble to the Treaty of Rome that's considered the founding document of European integration. And while Britain did get, in essence, an opt-out from this, it's not clear that that's meaningful at all because there is widespread agreement among legal people in the European Union that the phrase itself is, as they put it, politically important but not legally binding. It's not clear what it commits anybody to, if anything. So to have an exemption from something that has no legal foundation other than a general commitment that was meant for political purposes to bring everybody together, it's not clear what concretely Britain got out of that. And so I'm not sure that the British government is able to make a very powerful case that it got a better deal for Britain. And that raises the broader question of whether or not the government is making an effective case for staying in.
There seem to be a lot of arguments made basically just for symbolic reasons in some ways. Well, in the couple minutes we have left, tell us what your prediction may be. And we're going to check back in with you, of course, after the referendum and see what happens. But what is your prediction for the UK? And really, if you could connect it to, I mean, this they aren't the only ones that are having these kinds of discussions, right? I mean, there are others in the European Union that also are grappling with whether we stay or whether we go. And so, you know, not only a prediction about the UK, but kind of thoughts about others in Europe and kind of the future of the European Union. This is, I mean, they're struggling, this longstanding institution struggling, but yet is it strong enough to you know, kind of ride through this and come out the other end stronger?
You know, I've said this before, that I consider the refugee crisis really an existential crisis for the European Union, because the European Union, if anything, is an entity that claims to represent a set of values, tolerance, rule of law, and it's not clear that those values have prevailed in the refugee crisis. So we're at a juncture where a country, you know, a large, significant country leaving could really have dramatic consequences. And I think that's kind of the most recent twist on this whole thing. Most of the focus has been on what are the consequences for the British if they leave. And the question you're asking now is, what about the rest of the European Union? And I think the consequences can be worrisome. So the rest of the European Union now has, in some sense, a larger stake or concern in this than they did previously. I think what we're seeing is that I looked at the latest polls, and they're extremely close. I have always maintained, I've talked about this in my European Union classes on campus, that once somebody, a government, consistently made the case for Europe, that the polls would move in favor of staying in. That's only happened to a very modest degree. And I think the latest polls show, just within the last few days, I think an Economist poll showed a 41-40 advantage for leaving, and a Financial Times poll showed a 43-41 advantage for staying in. So essentially a dead heat. So it can absolutely go either way, which I find surprising. I find that especially surprising, given that the government is now making the case for staying in. And it raises additional questions. What if they do decide to leave, what happens to the Cameron government? Does he have to resign after advocating for staying in? So there's a tremendous amount at stake for Britain, for the government, and for Europe.
All right. Well, Mitchell, we will be paying close attention to what happens during this referendum, and we'll be back in touch to see what you think after the results.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Mitchell Smith. He's the chair of the University of Oklahoma's Department of International and Area Studies and the director of the European Union Center. There's more information and links to NPR's coverage of the upcoming Brexit vote on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and OU's College of International Studies. Miranda Wilson prepares our research, and Brian Hardzinski serves as our digital editor. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolotte.